From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we look at the history of public mental health funding and what it looks like today. Then the Milwaukee Election Commission shares tips on how to plan ahead for the November election.
Just because we are in a pandemic, I think voters want to think a lot about election preparation, planning for the election, recognize that things can be different than previous elections.
Plus, our auto contributor Mark Savage talks about the rise of the crossover.
As cars and sedans and coupes have kind of at least decreased in popularity, it was natural that then something like this was going to fill a niche because the crossovers on the other end of the scale had already been growing and moving ahead.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. There has been an ongoing conversation about mental health care in the U.S. After tragedies like the school shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary or Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, some political actors are quick to blame mental health issues. But despite these political talking points, public funding for mental health care has plummeted over the past few decades. And the history of mental health care in this country is fraught with mismanagement and abuse, often exacerbated by a lack of funding. Zeb Larson is a historian whose work has looked at the history of public mental health care in the U.S., and he joins me to talk about it. Zeb, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to start here. How long have there been public institutions in the United States that deal with mental health?
Well, that's a really interesting question there, Joy. When this country is created, formally, mental health care at a public level is extremely weak. In fact, it's mostly delivered through jails, you know, sort of informally providing care basically for people who live there long term. And it's private institutions that initially provide much of this service. In fact, it's Quaker institutions, first in Philadelphia, who I think opened one of the very first such hospitals in the United States. And these are what are referred to as asylums. They start to expand more as you get into the 1840s and 1850s. And that happens for a few reasons. Much of that is simply the growth of a large urban population. Cities, when the United States is first founded, they're pretty small, especially compared to anything you might find in Europe. But by the time you get to the 1840s and 1850s, you have these increasingly large cities, and these also, it's not yet quite urban exactly, but urbanizing population where it's not necessarily feasible to have a family care long-term for an ill individual. So they start to get moved into hospitals. And this is where you see the slow birth of a hospital system in the United States.
So when we move into these hospitals, what does care start to look like there? Because it's my understanding that for a lot of our history, mental illness itself was looked at very differently.
That's a really excellent point. And it is, I think you could say it's in many ways dramatically different from what we would expect today, for that matter. There's a great deal of focus in the 19th century, particularly, on trying to find permanent cures through what eventually they're going to call mental hygiene. That's a term that evolves later. But what it looks like in the 1840s and 1850s, as this sort of professionalizes, is this idea that you could rehabilitate people suffering from certain forms of mental illness by putting them in healthier surroundings. This almost invariably means taking them out of cities and moving them to the country, putting them to work at certain forms of rehabilitating work, so farming. This is actually why most mental hospitals in the United States, into the 1960s in many cases, actually had large working farms on them. Part of it was so that they could be self-sustaining and require, frankly, smaller budget appropriations from state governments, but it was also so, in many cases, they could put the people who worked there or lived there to some kind of work. And that's what ends up happening. So treatment is this kind of moral treatment that tries to restore people to what doctors perceive as sort of mental health. And that really sort of means making them productive. And then they can go back out and, in many cases, go back to what they had been previously doing before.
So when does mental health care, in the way that we view it today, when does that really start to emerge?
Well, there's a storied history to that one. I have to use that particular term for it. So this focus on sort of moral treatment and rehabilitation, it doesn't really work the way that doctors want it to. For one thing, a lot of forms of mental illness, they just don't respond to it that way. We know this now. So what happens over the course of the 19th century is that more and more people start to go into these hospitals. And these hospitals had always been founded with the assumption that people will get better, they will leave, we will take in new patients, cure them. But that's not really how it works for a lot of people. In many cases, they're chronically ill, especially with the kinds of treatments that are open to people in the 19th and early 20th centuries. So the hospital populations just swell. They keep getting bigger to the point that they far really outgrow what they had ever been intended to sort of house. And then at a certain point, doctors begin looking for new kinds of treatments to get away from what they call the warehousing of patients. And there are several treatments they arrive at that are really unsuccessful, but they embrace for a time because it seems doing something is better than doing nothing. And then beginning in the 1940s and early 1950s, we arrive at the development of actual antipsychotic drugs and antidepressants. And once those enter the picture, this is really transformative for these institutions because doctors are able to prescribe treatments that for many people dramatically improve their symptoms, sometimes at the cost of certain side effects, sometimes only for periods of time. But compared to the tools that had been available to them previously, they're more effective by a whole order of magnitude.
Now, at this point, it seems like we enter a very interesting part of this history. And I'm interested to know, you know, alongside this treatment, this medical treatment for mental health, what were the political perspectives on these kinds of institutions, especially as we look at public health institutions?
You know, these institutions in the early to mid 19th century, they were embraced a little bit more positively, to the point that actually there was a bill that went up in front of Congress in the 1850s that actually would have used government owned land to actually fund a series of federal mental health asylums. It doesn't get passed. Franklin Pierce vetoes it, as I recall, and then that's sort of the end of the word on federal involvement. Then it falls to the states. And what it becomes for the states is an increasingly an expensive item that they have to allocate money to year after year and face rather sharp growth over, especially because the U.S. population ages a lot in this period compared to previous history. So politically, up to the 1930s, 1940s, you mostly see both parties doing anything that they can to try to get people out of hospitals. It's in the wake of World War II that you see Democrats especially, but in many cases Republicans, I'm thinking of some Western states here as well, that they look to the federal government as a new tool to drive mental health care. They see, and this is where you see Truman, for example, in 1946, pass the Federal Mental Health Act that creates the National Institute of Mental Health. You don't see immediately them stepping in and providing more money for the hospitals and the asylums, but there's this increasing role that the federal government comes to play, and that it continues until the mid-1960s, at which point you have President Kennedy create, this was actually, I think, the last law that he signs before he's assassinated in November of 1963, creating community mental health centers that will be administered by the federal government. So that's sort of, as quickly as I can, about a century's worth of political evolution on the topic.
Well, and as we move forward from the 1960s, I mean, as you mentioned, of course, we start to get drugs, antipsychotic drugs, that are able to treat people in a way that they don't have to be institutionalized. We also, of course, have, you know, earlier in the 20th century, the reports of real mistreatment at a lot of these institutions that cause a lot of, you know, public uproar against them. As we move into an era of that seems like the prevailing thought is deinstitutionalizing people, removing them from these places of care. How does that impact the funding for these kinds of mental health facilities?
Well, that's a great question. That actually, I mean, in some ways touches most closely on my own interest in this topic, is that in many cases, there were a lot of people, and really on both sides of the political aisle in this country, who thought that these new drugs, chlorpromazine, for example, that they would in some ways enable them to get rid of the hospital system entirely. There were sort of, and from the perspective of somebody living in 2020, they seem wildly optimistic. These projections that mental illness itself could entirely be cured because of these drugs. So in many cases, and this is true of some of the federal blue ribbon panels that are created in the 1950s to study this issue, there is this expectation that with enough money basically going to drug treatment, they'll just be able to close the hospitals almost entirely. And this is where you start to run up against some of the science of it, because while there are large numbers of people who respond very effectively to medications, they also run up against some people whose symptoms are more treatment resistant, who might require greater social safety net supports. So as you get into the 1960s and 1970s, you start to see more difficult discharges of people who require more support than is actually available to them in order to live effectively in the community, which in turn means that more resources get shifted away from hospitals to support those individuals, but then the hospitals themselves continue to suffer in quality. This is why you see throughout the 1960s and onward a number of scandals and revelations that come out about the way people are treated in many of the hospitals, patient neglect, for example.
Well, and the figure who you point out, especially in the federal government, is President Ronald Reagan and his 1981 Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Bill. Can you unpack that a bit and how it impacted state community mental health centers?
So what Reagan does with the 1980 Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Bill, boy, that title is just a mouthful, isn't it? But what it does is it alters a funding scheme that had been relatively stable from Kennedy in 1963 to Reagan in 1980, in which the federal government provided X amount of money to these community mental health centers, and the expectation was that states would match the funds, and it was sort of a complicated funding scheme. And Reagan changes the funding structure very dramatically. First, there are dramatic cuts made in this period, and then the remainder of the money is, in many cases, allocated back to the states as block grants, meaning that they can do with those funds what they wish to do, which means in many cases they're not going to use it to use for mental health treatment, but they might use it to plug a different hole in the budget. So what you start to see then is this reduced level of federal commitment. And this, in turn, forces a number of hospitals to close. I do like to sort of put a cautionary note on describing too much of this to Reagan, because I think that in many ways what Reagan did in 1980 was sort of the culminating logic of this idea of deinstitutionalization, that we have more effective treatment mechanisms in the community, and in many cases, to be clear, they are more effective. So we can just kind of keep getting rid of the hospitals. That is sort of the end point of this logic. That is, incidentally, what he did as governor in California through the 1960s. So his actions as president, I don't think they're unique. Let me put it that way.
The idea being that even if Reagan hadn't been president, it's likely that another president would have passed something similar.
Indeed. And in many cases, a lot of the forces that are unleashed because of that, they're already sort of in play at the state level. That's where mental health care in this country is just so tricky, is that it's such a complicated interplay now between the federal government and the state government, because it's money coming from both sides. So it's very rarely just a monocausal thing.
Well, and to look at just the last few decades since that was passed, and since, you know, we've seen a lot of mental health facilities close in cities around the country. What has been the impact of defunding, not just at the federal level, but also at the state level, for these kinds of institutions?
Well, the institutions themselves, I mean, the hospitals have really become what they call forensic institutions. And by that, I mean, they really only cater to individuals who have committed a crime of some kind or might be dangerous, and so they get sentenced there. I'm thinking about my home state, Oregon. In Oregon, the Oregon State Hospital is almost exclusively for people who have committed a crime but been found not guilty by reason of insanity. There are some individuals who get sent there to stabilize while awaiting trial, but that really is it. Oregon State Hospital overwhelmingly exists for that purpose. And the other state hospitals, Eastern Oregon State, for example, they've closed. So increasingly the focus is individuals will be treated only in communities at this sort of decentralized level. And how that, I think, plays out is then people are sort of at the whim of what the county and the state is willing to supply them, which means that even within a state, you get, I think it's safe to say, pretty wildly divergent outcomes in terms of access, in terms of how many people there are, in terms of the resources, and then, of course, whatever the economic situation is at the moment.
Well, and of course, now we're talking about people who frequently in conversations would be labeled as criminals. And so when we're talking about giving funds to people who can be labeled as criminals, it becomes a little bit more complicated on a political level.
It does. And this is also where it dovetails with, in many ways, mental illness has been recriminalized in this country. Remember, I said at the beginning of this that in the 1780s, 1790s, people were frequently treated in jails. We're back to that. The three largest mental health providers in the United States are Rikers Island, Los Angeles County Jail, and the Cook County Jail. This is overwhelmingly where people receive treatment. That's actually true at a smaller city level as well. So this is where, the mental health system just gets very complicated in this country.
Well, and to kind of sum it up, how would you describe where our mental health system is today, specifically our public mental health system, at a time when we're talking more and more about mental health for a variety of reasons, for often criminal reasons, but different socioeconomic outcomes that we'd like to change?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I'm a historian, so the closer I get to the present, the more uncomfortable I become in some ways. But I will say, what we've seen is, on the one hand, tremendous improvements in some ways. There is so much better understanding of mental health than there was 100 years ago. And increasingly, what they call the consumer perspective, which is to say the person who receives treatment, they are actually given a voice in a way that they would not have been 100 years ago. And I will just go to my grave maintaining that that is a tremendous historical justice that we've managed to write. However, what we've also exposed is that increasingly access to quality public mental health care in many ways depends on socioeconomic factors, which means there are a great many people who end up on the losing line of that. And that is something that we have not really rectified in this country. And to be honest, I think when people set out on deinstitutionalization, I'm not really sure that they were thinking through exactly how complicated this question was going to become.
Yeah. Well, Zeb, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you for having me.
Zeb Larson is a historian whose work has looked at the history of mental health care and treatment in the U.S. We'll take a quick break, then get a refresher on how to vote by mail in the November election. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Earlier this week, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled Green Party candidate Howie Hawkins would not be allowed on the ballot for the November general election. The decision cleared the way for clerks to begin mailing ballots to people hoping to vote absentee in November. Concerns over the spread of COVID-19 is leading to an uptick in mail-in voting. So information on how to get your ballot is more important than ever before. For a primer ahead of the election, WUWM's Mayon Silver spoke with Neil Albrecht, the former executive director of the Milwaukee Election Commission. He's assisting the department as they prepare for the election. He starts by explaining the voter registration process.
So we're very fortunate in the state of Wisconsin that anyone can request a by-mail absentee ballot. We are what's called a no excuse state for absentee voting. As long as they are eligible to vote and as long as they are registered to vote at their current address.
And people can go to register online at myvote.wi.gov. Is that correct?
They can. So if a person needs to update their registration, the best way to do that is at the MyVote website, where they can register if they are a new Wisconsin voter. They can also update their registration if they were previously registered but have moved since then. And again, they would want to complete that process before requesting an absentee ballot.
And what do you need to register to vote?
So Wisconsin has something called a proof of residence requirement in order to register to vote. Basically, some sort of an acceptable document that includes your name and your current address, the address that you're going to be registering at, and it proves that you reside at that address. So some of the more commonly presented proof of residences include things like your Wisconsin driver's license or your state ID, if they have your name and current address on them, a bank statement, a utility bill, a paycheck stub, any correspondence, like any document that you've received from a unit of government. It's important to note that government is pretty big. We have city government, county, state, and federal government. So it can be anything from, for example, on the local level, from the city of Milwaukee, on the national level, something from Social Security. And everything in between, as long as it's a unit of government, qualifies as a document issued by a unit of government. It's a pretty extensive list. Also things like a lease, a property tax bill, a receipt for paying your property taxes. I think that there are a number of good options for residents.
So when people register, they need to show their name and current address, but they don't need to show a photo ID when they're registering.
That's correct. It's really kind of a two-step process. First, you have to prove your residence when you register to vote by meeting the proof of residence requirement. Second, you need to prove your identity by providing your photo ID when you actually are requesting a ballot or voting on election day. And if I could just back us up a little bit and say, when you are registering to vote on the MyVote website, as long as you have a Wisconsin driver's license or state ID, you can actually update your address with the DMV as part of that registration process. So I don't want voters to think that they have to go to the DMV, update their ID prior to registering. They can actually do that as part of the process.
Gotcha. Well, and what else do people need to know about registration?
So you have to meet the qualifications to vote in order to register, which is you cannot be serving probation or parole for a felony conviction. You have to be 18 years of age by election day, and you have to be a U.S. citizen. You also have to be a resident at the address that you are registering to vote for at least 10 days preceding the August election. And now I'll say sometimes laws change, election law changes, even between elections. And so it looks like for the November election, the registration residency requirement will be 28 days before the election. That means you have to be residing at your address for at least 28 days prior to that November election in order to register to vote at that address. If you have moved within that 28 days, it's actually okay to continue to vote from your previous address.
And so someone's, let's say they're registered to vote, what are the three ways that they can vote now?
So they've got three good options. The same even during this time of a pandemic, it's the three options that are normally available to voters. The first one I'll say is the one that we encourage because it is the safest in terms of health and safety and the pandemic, and that is to request an absentee ballot by mail. So that would be a ballot sent to a voter's home or mailing address. So there's by mail absentee voting. There will continue to be in-person absentee or early voting at sites across the city in the 2 weeks preceding the election. And then, of course, there is voting at a polling place on election day. I do want to add to the last item, the election day polling place or voting site, that because of the pandemic, there can be some last minute changes to polling places or voting sites. So very important, good practice for anyone who plans on voting at their voting site on election day to confirm that site prior to the election. Again, they can do that at the My Vote website. Just because we are in a pandemic, I think voters want to think a lot about election preparation, planning for the election, recognize that things can be different than previous elections, and a part of that is confirm your voting site.
And let's talk about mail-in voting in particular. How does someone request a mail-in ballot?
So the easiest way to request an absentee ballot is to do so at that My Vote website. I think we're kind of covering a couple of times here. This My Vote website, which is offered by the state, is really the easiest public access to voting besides going to a polling place on election day. At that My Vote site, you can register to vote, you can request an absentee ballot, you can confirm your voting site, you can confirm your registration status. It's really good for members of the public to develop a familiarity with that website. But I also recognize that not everyone in the city of Milwaukee has access or consistent access to the internet. So if going to that My Vote website is not a good option for requesting an absentee ballot, they can go to any number of Milwaukee Public Library branches. They are open Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. It's a list of the library branches that's published on our website, and they can go and request assistance with the absentee application process. The final option would be just go ahead and call the Election Commission at 414-286-3491 or 414-286-VOTE. Just identify that you would like to receive an absentee ballot for the upcoming elections, and staff are available to provide assistance with people in order to complete that request process.
And what's the deadline for requesting a mail-in ballot?
So the deadline for most voters is the Thursday preceding the election. If it is for a voter that is indefinitely confined, and I'll provide the definition, a voter can identify as indefinitely confined if they are unable to appear to vote on election day due to age, illness, or disability. They actually have until the Friday preceding the election to make that request. So Thursday for most voters, Friday before the election for those that identify or certify as indefinitely confined. I do want to add that even though state statutes have those deadlines in place, I would not encourage people to wait until those deadlines to request their absentee ballots, just because we know that there are some delays right now with mail delivery, and you want to make sure there's enough time for you to receive your ballot, vote your ballot, and return it to be counted in the election.
And what's the deadline for returning the ballot?
Your ballot has to be received by 8 p.m. on election day, either by mail or at any of the Dropbox locations that we have established in the city of Milwaukee. And what I mean by Dropbox is somebody that's requested an absentee ballot will receive with their ballot a list of Dropboxes where they can just take that ballot and drop it in to the Dropbox, and they don't have to rely on the Postal Service for returning that ballot. Most Milwaukee Public Library locations have Dropboxes for both the August and the November elections.
And can you talk about the witness signature very briefly?
Yeah, it's very important that anybody voting by mail absentee follow each step of the instructions that's provided with their absentee ballot. One of those instructions is you have to have a witness signature on your absentee ballot. That's somebody who will sign and provide their full address as verification that you are the person who voted your absentee ballot. That can be a spouse, a roommate, a neighbor. As long as they are an eligible voter, they can sign as your witness. I know that some people actually even use their postal carrier to sign as their witness, and then they ask that postal carrier to take the ballot with them.
And can you talk about ballot tracking at all? Do the ballots get tracked both when they're sent from the municipal clerk's office and then when they're returned by the voter?
Yeah, so the state of Wisconsin just phased in intelligent barcodes on absentee ballots. So they are tracked from the moment that the mailing label is generated until it actually goes out in the mail, till it's received by the voter, mailed back to the election commission. You can track the status of your absentee ballot. It's really to improve the performance of by mail absentee voting in the state of Wisconsin. You do that on the My Vote website. So again, it's a terrific site to voters who really want to be informed in terms of voting options, how to register, how to request an absentee ballot, and then how to track your ballot.
All right. Well, Neil Albrecht, thanks for sharing how to vote and how to vote by mail.
Thank you for inviting me on the show.
Neil Albrecht is the former executive director of the Milwaukee Election Commission, and he spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver in August. Coming up next, auto contributor Mark Savage talks about the rise of the crossover vehicle. Lake Effect will return in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Crossover vehicles have been steadily growing and taking over the auto market. Starting at just 4% of car sales in 2000, they reached about 40% of sales in 2018. The Honda CR-V, Toyota RAV4, and the Nissan Rogue are the three top sellers. And while we may be driving less right now, the demand for crossover vehicles likely won't slow down. Auto contributor Mark Savage joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about what makes crossovers a popular choice.
You know, I think it's a combination of things. It's the crossovers are more economical to run. They usually cost less than a big SUV or a pickup truck. And they're useful, and you're not paying the big price premium, and they actually look better than most of the, you know, big SUVs are pretty boxy and square.
Right, and there is now a slight difference. We have crossovers and compact crossovers, so can you explain those? And is it like a huge difference, or is it just kind of subtle in nature?
Well, I think the crossovers kind of started out as a car-based vehicle, and they still are. It's just that most of them started out as kind of a midsize. So you're looking at something that maybe was based like a RAV4 or something like that on a Camry chassis. And Now they're just trying to make them a little smaller and a little more, I think, fuel efficient is part of it, and to lower the cost, because, you know, most cars are and crossovers have been in that $35,000 to $37,000 range, and some of the new ones that they've introduced in the last couple of years are both smaller, a little lower horsepower, and are now down into that $20,000 to $30,000 range. So it makes it a broader audience, at least, that can get it, and probably ends up being a second car for a lot of families too.
So do you think that cost component is the main reason that the compact crossover, does it fill a significant consumer gap?
Yeah, I think that's what we're seeing is that part of the market used to be small cars, and the small cars are not as useful as a small crossover because they're a little boxier, depending on, you know, the styling of that particular one. So this fills that niche that maybe you used to buy a Honda Civic, and now, of course, they've grown to be larger, and you're looking for something that's small that maybe is a second car, might be for a kid going off to college or even still in high school, or just something to back you up that, you know, you've got a family car and you need something else that you can use on the weekends to run people around.
So you mentioned it's perhaps taking the place of a normal car for families. Does the fuel economy of a Crossroad significantly differ from those?
Well, they're not dramatically different, and that's what's good about them, is that some of them are very similar in gas consumption, maybe a little bit off, you know, maybe 1 mile per gallon or something like that. But in the meantime, you've got, I think they said the industry average was like 1.5 times as much cargo room in the vehicle. So, I might be able to throw in, you know, more soccer gear in the back, or take it to, you know, the Home Depots of the world and pick up stuff from the utility places like that and pick up stuff to bring home for gardening or working around the house and so forth. So I just think that as cars and sedans and coupes have kind of at least decreased in popularity, it was natural that then something like this was going to fill the niche, because the crossovers on the other end of the scale had already been growing and moving ahead.
Well, I think one niche they're also filling in kind of a fun way is the style and the look of these cars.
Right. And I think, being a guy that has always liked hatchbacks because they had a more of a fastback look to them, I think that crossovers offer that. And, you know, some are boxy, but some of them are not. I guess what I think of that came out this year is the Mazda CX-30, which is just the cutest thing. I think that one of the cutest things that's out there. I mean, it looks like they took, you know, a Mazda 3 hatchback and jacked it up and put it just a little bit higher with a little bigger wheels and so forth. And, you know, that's not a bad thing, to have something that's a little sporty looking, that's still fun to drive. And it actually drives very much like a car because it's based on a car. And I think, you know, the manufacturers have just tried to make these look more attractive, and it's not just another, you know, box on wheels.
Well, and on the note of box on wheels, you said it's truly based on a car. So even though it's smaller with smaller wheels and you may be sitting lower, this doesn't necessarily translate to a rougher drive?
Not necessarily. And the drive and the ride, and it usually depends on the wheelbase. And my kind of standard is, I think you want about 106-inch wheelbase to get yourself a really good ride, or at least a decent ride on our crater-like roads that we have in Wisconsin. But some of these are a little smaller than that, maybe 103, 104-inch wheelbase, and a couple are even smaller yet than that. But they have worked much harder, I think, to make these more manageable and smoother so that you don't feel like you're driving a truck, which I think that's one of the things that wasn't attractive about the SUVs. You know, a lot of people thought that they looked sporty and tough and, I guess, manly in some way, but they rode like trucks. And so you bounced over every bump in the road and so forth. These are much, much smoother and much nicer riding. And if they are a little jiggly, they're not a lot jiggly. So that's always a good thing.
Not a lot jiggly. That's
yeah, not a lot jiggly.
Next head title for your next review.
And that you know, that's a scientific term that I like to use, yes.
So we have the cost, styling, ease of drive, ease of use, and the economy of it. What newer crossovers have been introduced to the market? You know, what have you taken for a spin recently? You mentioned the Mazda. Are there any other top contenders, you think?
I should mention that, you know, when you're thinking of these kind of crossovers, the Toyota RAV4, Honda CR-V, and the Nissan Rogue are the three top sellers in this kind of category to begin with. But this year alone, the CR-V was redone, and I drove both the gas and the hybrid powered ones. And personally, I like the hybrid one better because I'm getting much better gas mileage. I got 43, almost 44 miles per gallon, and with a gas powered one only, it's I got about 28. So you're getting a more economy that way, and you pay just a teeny bit more. It's not like you're paying $3,000 and $4,000 and $5,000 anymore for hybrids extra, but that's nice. And the hybrid has 212 horsepower, and you think for a small or compact crossover, that's really oodles. Another one that I really liked was the Kia Seltos, which I think is a great sounding name anyway. It's something different. Mine was a star bright yellow, which was just almost like I called it electric mustard because it was so bright. But that one's both cute. It has two-tone paint jobs, so you could have a black roof with it or something, so it makes it stand out a little bit more. And one of the nice things about it, and not all crossovers have all-wheel drive, but that one comes with all-wheel drive, and that was fully loaded. It was under $30,000. And you think it had a roomy enough interior that you could easily put a family of four in there and go pretty much anywhere. So I like that one real well. I know Hyundai has had the Kona out in the past, and this year it came out with the Venue, which now, if you like boxy styling, that kind of goes back that way. It looks a little more Jeep-like to me anyway. And that one starts, and I know this is hard to believe, at under $19,000. So like $18,500, and that's with a manual transmission and about almost just under 20,000 for one with an automatic transmission. And again, doesn't have a lot of horsepower. It has 121 horses, which I know compared to, you know, most of these are 150, 160, 170. May not sound like a lot, but so many of the cars these days now have a sport mode that you can punch a button or turn a little dial. And what it does is it holds the lower gears longer. And so it gives you more oomph, more power off the line, so that if you're, you know, sitting at a stoplight, all that, you know, the guy behind you in the big F-150 isn't going to crush you because you're poking along. You can actually punch that and get going, and then you can go right back into the more economical mode. Then I know a couple things that are just coming out. The Subaru, of course, has had the Outback for ages, and they've had a Crosstrek before, but they have a new entry-level kind of crossover, the Crosstrek, that's coming out very shortly. That I think everybody's going to like. I haven't been able to drive one yet, but I'm assuming that we'll get one this fall sometime. And then Toyota, kind of pushing the envelope a little bit, is going reintroducing its Venza, which came out, I think it was 2008 originally, then it went away. But it's going to be a highly styled, kind of a compact, a little bit bigger crossover, back more into the mid-level. But I think it's going to be more luxurious, kind of along the lines of a Camry, which is, it started out kind of as a Camry wagon. It was kind of the thought, I think, at the time. So all those are, you know, coming out new. And obviously on the luxury end of things, there's always something coming out. Currently, there's, this last year I drove a Lexus UX250H, which means, the H means hybrid. And again, that one got about 44 miles per gallon, but now you're talking considerably more money. You're talking in the $40,000 range, but it is more luxurious. BMW, Mercedes, everybody's got something that they offer at this point. Also had a Volvo XC40, which is another new little one, and that one handled great and rode very nice. So there's another, you know, if you're looking for something a little more luxurious, that certainly would be one of the possibilities.
So crossovers are not just, you know, mid-level economic options. There are luxury ones as well. I never thought of that, honestly.
Yeah, there are luxury ones, you know, but again, now you're talking, probably most of the time you're talking $38,000 to $45,000 for starting price. And like anything else, if you load it up with everything, you might hit $50,000 or so. To some of us, that still seems like a lot of money, but so I'm partial to the Mazdas and Subarus and Toyotas of the world that come in a little less than that.
Definitely. Well, there's certainly a range of choices for people to choose from when it comes to crossovers.
Right. And they'll be economical, at least to drive at that point.
All right. Well, thank you, Mark.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Mark Savage is Lake Effect's auto contributor, and you can find all of our past segments with him at WUWM.com, along with his weekly column. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. Coming up, we'll have an essay from Lake Effect contributor Joanne Nelson. That's when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect Now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. In the not-so-distant past, going to conferences was common. Whether for work or a hobby, conferences can give people meaningful experiences. For contributor Joanne Nelson, writers' conferences would give her energy and help hone her craft. But she sometimes wonders if her desire to be out exploring instead of at home could lead to unforeseen consequences. Nelson shares her thoughts in this essay on coming home from the conference.
I came home from the conference buoyed by the breakout sessions, refreshed by time with friends, and packing plenty of convention hall swag. My flight came in early, and Bruce, my husband, met me outside the airport as planned. The house sparkled and smelled of pine sol when I arrived, happy to be home and grateful for my better half. A guy who enjoys cleaning and takes good care of the family. After I unpacked, I headed into the upstairs bathroom and discovered a new ruby-colored curtain adorning the window overlooking our backyard. I called to Bruce. "It's okay, but it sure cuts off the view." "We can take it down." "No, no, it's fine." In the shower, washing the travel away and returning to myself as wife and mom, I noticed a new body wash, Dial for Men. It sported an attractive red and gold label featuring the word magnetic and the tag attraction enhancing. Underneath this, penetrated by a strip of manly blue, was the phrase pheromone infused. What, you might ask yourself, as I did while working my own mild-mannered shampoo into my hair, is a contented husband doing with the body wash labeled pheromone infused? And, you might wonder, again as I did having moved on to conditioner, exactly what pheromone infused means. I thought pheromones were naturally occurring chemicals that withered away once you were happily married. The phrase attraction enhancing concerned me. Although I figured product placement in such a highly trafficked area, used by daughters, guests, and me, implied a certain innocence. Or could it suggest an initial, subconscious inkling of dissatisfaction in what, only moments earlier, had seemed a solid marriage? In fact, toweling off, I pictured myself typing these very words on some future tearful morning. Alone but for a lukewarm cup of coffee, relating how I missed the first signs of trouble and paid the price, the children only visiting and the house for sale. Bruce, now with a woman more appreciative of his window treatments, who would remark on how the color complemented the tile flooring instead of criticizing. A woman who would have been at home helping instead of off adventuring. Bruce was watching television when I came downstairs. Regretting my comments about the new bathroom curtain, I casually asked, "So what's with the body wash? The pheromone-infused one?" He replied, "It was on sale. $279." After describing the cost of the other brands, he added, "I don't even know what pheromones are." I countered, "Well, you know what attraction enhancing means." "I don't think it says that." Bruce refused to understand the implications. He suggested no need for enhancement was necessary as he remained a stud muffin. Then he returned to the antics on Storage Wars. I couldn't let it go. For days I studied the accusatory black letters throbbing against the blue ribbon. I wondered if this was how it happens, small omens lapped off or dismissed in the busyness of work and raising kids. Eventually, I had to ask myself, why all the concentration on this? After all, aren't I the one with opportunities? Night after night of post-conference schmoozing and at least all that elbow rubbing? It's not only opportunity, it's history. My family includes generations of gallivanters. Heck, both my great-grandfather and father became midlife runaways. Perhaps projection scented my over-concentration on body wash. I'm attracted to the adventuring, though, not some need to stray. An ever-increasing desire to be off exploring more than at home decorating. It's an itchy feeling of not fitting in when everyone gathers around the TV for the night. It's an understanding that my fears of becoming like my over-anxious mother may have kept me from recognizing the more captivating danger, that of my father's wanderlust. Several days later, I pinned back the curtain, the color nice against the woodwork, the window no longer muffled. "Did you notice I changed the curtain?" I asked Bruce when he hadn't praised my domestic exertion within an hour. "Yeah, you can see the backyard a lot better." He was right. The hammock swaying between our apple trees, the patio furniture, and our colorful flower baskets were more inviting without the gauzy material in the way. Too often it was my thoughts I saw outside the window, though, my focus resting on whatever confirmed the images tumbling around my head. Maybe my own sneaky pheromones caterwauling through the air, looking for trouble. But most days, it's the cars journeying on the highway, just visible beyond our backyard, that catch and hold my attention. At least as much as the hammock, the planters, and the cushioned deck chairs.
Lake Effect contributor Joanne Nelson lives in Heartland, Wisconsin, and she's the author of This Is How We Leave. You can find more of her essays at WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Audrey Nowakowski and Becca Schimmel join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Jack Urbanis. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Mayan Silver and Latoya Dennis from the WUWM news team this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. And Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can join us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.